Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. It's hard to imagine a world where we leave future generations with fewer rights and freedoms. Since the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills aimed at blocking people from getting the essential sexual and reproductive care they need, including abortion. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves access to care. And with supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia with ease, travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk, and take away the guesswork that goes along with converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com. That's Wise, WISE.com. Wise.com.
Hell yeah, controlled substances.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Jane Costin, ProPublica's Tara Lind. I wanted to talk about, Tara recently published a big investigative piece.
Yeah, the thing about the difference between being at ProPublica and being at Vox.com is that now when I publish a piece, it's an event as opposed to just like a weekday.
It's a slower metabolism. So I was like, oh, we should talk about Dara's big piece she's been working on. So I arranged that. Then I actually read it, and it's too depressing.
It's yes. It is not exactly a heartwarming and uplifting piece.
This is
although it does actually have a happy ending, which is one of the things about investigative journalism, or at least one of the things about kind of writing about immigration policy in the Trump era is that I constantly have this dynamic when reporting out pieces where whenever anything good happens to someone I am following, I have to have a conversation with myself and or my editor along the lines of, is this still a representative story? Because many stories don't have happy endings.
Sure.
And
that's
if
correct.
Not, like, you know, is that so it creates this weird perverse incentive, right? Where you end up rooting against good things to happen to
right.
people who you know, have interacted with and may care about,
but
because
then,
it wouldn't make.
What is this about?
As Weeds listeners know, because it's been kind of an axe that I've been grinding, that certain other folks in kind of immigration world have been grinding for the last year, the Trump administration has put a lot of effort into, instead of taking in asylum seekers when they arrive in the U.S. and keeping them in custody or letting them, you know, be released into the community while they wait for their asylum cases, they've found various ways to kind of just get them out of the U.S. as quickly as possible. The best established one of these is known as the Remain in Mexico program. It's officially called the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP. And it means that people do have asylum cases in the U.S., but they are sent over the border to Mexico while they wait for those asylum cases. Now, these aren't Mexican asylum seekers. These are mostly Central American, but also other Latin American migrants, now even Brazilians who don't necessarily even speak Spanish, are being, you know, something on the level of 50,000, although no count is super consistent on this. People have been sent over the last year to wait. More recently, they've started piloting things that don't actually give people full asylum cases in the U.S. system at all. Some pilots that just deport people, like they give them expedited review and then deport them quickly. And more recently, just sending people who are from Honduras and El Salvador to Guatemala to ask for asylum
okay,
there.
So
now, the thing about all of these is the decision about who goes where, whether somebody stays in the U.S., goes to Guatemala, goes to Mexico, that's entirely up to Border Patrol. And there
And that
are,
can differ even where you
yes.
are at Border. One of the things you get
yeah.
into in your story, which just to give everyone, we'll put it in the show notes, but it's called Women to One Side, Men to the Other, How the Border Patrol's New Powers and Old Carelessness Separated a Family. But one thing you mentioned briefly is that if you are an LGBTQ asylum seeker and you go to El Paso versus San
yeah.
Francisco, you may may have an entirely different experience of Border Patrol.
Right. Border Patrol is giving these, like, very vague, like, maybe you should consider not sending people to Mexico if they're in these circumstances. But they're very clear that it is up to individual officers to make that decision.
And these officers have likely not received any training about how to recognize threats or what asylum seekers should or could look like.
Right.
And so I think one of the things that you did really well in the story, which I strongly encourage everyone to read, is just how shambles panda this all is. Like, just abject.
Yeah.
Just in terms of, like, oh, we didn't write down who, you know, that this child was this person's son or this person's child. And so we have no idea. We don't know where people are supposed to be. It's not even, like, mistakes. It's just, like, errors.
Right. It's the folks, the kind of family that's referred to in the headline that I was following for this story, I was down in El Paso Juarez in September and, you know, was talking to a lawyer, and she mentioned that she'd actually been working with someone who I'd spoken to in the Bay Area and that they were working on a Remain in Mexico case, which didn't make a whole lot of sense because the Bay Area is not close to the border. But what became clear was that the lawyer in the Bay Area was representing the mother and had reached out to this lawyer in Texas to find the father of the family, because the father and son had been sent back to Mexico under the Remain in Mexico program. The family had come together, or at least, you know, as far as we knew at that point, they were saying that they had come together, and there wasn't any evidence otherwise. But they had been told to get on separate buses when they got apprehended. They got taken to the same Border Patrol station, but they got taken separately, so they got put into processing separately, and that was it. And one of them got released into the U.S. The mother and her, you know, 20-month-old daughter, their 20-month-old daughter got allowed to go to the U.S., but the father and 6-year-old son, because they'd been put on the bus with the men, ended up separated from them and got sent back to Juarez, and had at that point been there for nearly 4 months. Ultimately, as I was following this family, after a bunch of hoops to jump through and attempts to get them reunited that didn't work, ultimately Border Patrol kind of decided that they were going to take them out of the Remain in Mexico program and allow them to reunite. But that happened as suddenly and unaccountably as the separation to begin with. So I was able to actually, you know, go with them as the family reunited for the first time in 4 months. But it wasn't the result of, oh, you know, we held the system accountable and they did what they were supposed to do. It was this power that was exercised to separate the family without any consequences was then able to reunite the family without any consequences. So it's a bit of a tricky subject for an investigative piece because, in a way, it's writing about kind of the absence of processes or of anything written down. And, you know, you do have to kind of I had to kind of prove the negative that there wasn't any reason that this family would have been separated in processing, which I ultimately was able to do. But we don't know how many of these there are. There is no reason to believe that this family would have been reunited if the lawyer hadn't been essentially, you know, hadn't emailed a bunch of CBP lawyers and kind of leadership at the port of entry in Juarez in saying, this is a mistake and you need to fix this because otherwise we're going to start escalating. It's just, we have no way of knowing whether this is something that happens all the time, whether it's something that they're taking any more care with now that they could be sending people to Guatemala, or if this is just a reflection of a madness that, you know, exists and a carelessness that continues to exist even as Border Patrol agents aren't as overwhelmed as they were in summer last year.
And part of the story here is that a certain kind of decision-making function has been pushed sort of downstream onto the Border Patrol that they didn't traditionally exercise, right? I mean, they would be there at the border apprehending people who were sneaking across, and then people who made asylum claims, they would hand off, right? To ICE was in charge of detaining or not people, and there are asylum officers who were part of USCIS, and there is an immigration court
system.
Right.
Right. So there were like various decision-making nodes, but like the Border Patrol was like a permeable barrier at the border, right?
If they
caught you and you like your bag was full of drugs,
yes,
like they would arrest you because that's a crime. And if they got you and you were making an asylum claim, you had the credible fear hearing.
Right. But even then it was going to be, you know, you may recall from last summer when there was all of the outrage about conditions in Border Patrol custody, that Border Patrol sees its job as getting people out of its custody as quickly as possible, generally sending them to ICE. And so even though they did have a certain initial paperwork function, ICE was ultimately, A, making the decisions mm-hmm. about, like, who should be released and who should be detained, and B, it was kind of a second step to catch any carelessness that had happened in Border Patrol processing. Mm-hmm. Paperwork is not generally considered to be something that Border Patrol takes as a particularly important and awesome and worthwhile part of its job.
Clearly.
Sure. And,
clearly.
No, but I mean, they're cops, right?
Right?
They're not.
Yeah, something that didn't make it into the piece, but I spoke to someone who's currently in the government who's worked with Border Patrol, and, you know, they said they don't understand that what they write on the forms actually affects somebody's case down the road. They just think of it as like, it's a drop-down menu, you get it done to get it done.
Uh-huh.
And there have been lots and lots of evidence of Border Patrol agents just kind of copying and pasting from one thing to another. You'll have these obviously absurd results, like in one case, a 3-year-old child was marked on the form as saying that they came to the U.S. to work because that's just what had been copied and pasted. Mm-hmm. So, but when you were being sent to ICE custody as quickly as possible, ICE would be able to catch that, or you'd have your initial asylum screening interview and the asylum officer would be able to catch that. Right now, Border Patrol, in addition to having this added power to decide, do people go to Mexico? Do they go to Guatemala? Do they go into one of these expedited review programs? They also they're working without a net on the paperwork side, and there's no indication whatsoever that there's any more care being taken with paperwork. As a matter of fact, an internal review of the Remain in Mexico program, which got leaked to BuzzFeed in part late last year, said that they didn't even have standardized forms for what happened when they sent people back to Mexico. And, like, they rolled this program out very gradually. It was at one location, and then they'd send it to another location. So what appears to have been the case is different parts of the border were arranging different forms on their own rather than any kind of, oh, this is how we've been doing it over in San Ysidro. Oh, this, you know, so it's just – there's no indication that this is happening in a way that not only makes it clear to Border Patrol agents that what they're doing is now much more serious and has greater consequences, but that it's not being done in a way you would roll out a policy. It's just being done in a way you would kind of do it. You would roll out a new field tactic and give total discretion to the field agents to impose that tactic.
And then, obviously, then some of the secondary context is that the message from the top about this all is not, well, we need to do a really good job of correctly sorting people into destinations that will be safe for them and safeguard their rights, right? I mean, they are the Trump administration is trying to do things that will pass judicial scrutiny, but like the objective here is to make it so that people don't come make asylum claims in the United States, right? And like people understand that, right? Like, we're not idiots here on this podcast, and I assume they also aren't at the Border Patrol, right? That like what the bosses are asking them to do is make people not want to come here, right? So like it's not like going to be the end of your career as, you know, the shift supervisor at one particular border station if like there's a mess up and something sad happens to a family.
Right.
Like, what's going to be a problem for you is if, like, you get the reputation as, like, you definitely want to come to this guy's sector of the border because he's being generous.
Right.
Right? Like, that's not – like, the goal here is not to treat people nicely.
Yes. They're walking a difficult line because you don't – you know, as much of a problem as it is that this that decisions about whether you get to stay in the U.S. and make an asylum claim or not are not at all based in what is the asylum claim you're ultimately going to make. Like, the family in this story to this day has never actually had the chance to explain to an official of the United States government why they left Honduras. Uh-huh. That's not part of the triage process. And that sounds extremely arbitrary. But on the other hand, there is a process that exists for determining whether someone has a good enough claim that they should be able to make it in full. And that's the process that the Trump administration is currently abrogating. So you can kind of understand, you know, what they're saying that all of these strategies do a good job of, you know, that they make it easier to hear legitimate asylum claims by streamlining non-legitimate ones, which is slightly double talk because, of course, they're not making that decision. They're just kind of assuming that if you are willing to jump through all these hoops, you must have a better claim, right, or we must be able to just hear it more efficiently. What it means is that they're kind of making these, they have to just flatly assert that there is absolutely no difference between being sent to Mexico and given a court date in the U.S. that you're, like, shipped through the port for. You know, you have to show up to the port at Juarez at, like, 4:30 in the morning or whatever because your hearing's at 8:30 and, you know, it's going to take several hours to get through. That there's no difference between that and being in the U.S., able to kind of go find legal help. That's flatly everything we've seen about the way that these court hearings are working is that they are, in fact, totally different, that dockets are overloaded all the time, that that you really don't get any access to lawyers when you're in the U.S. And when you're in Mexico, lawyers aren't willing to go or don't want to take these cases because they're being so expedited and rushed through. They're going to some of the judges in the system that have that already have, like, the lowest approval ratings, or increasingly, they're just kind of teleconferencing in judges from elsewhere. The hearings aren't open to the public. And so, you know, you have the rhetorical, well, we're not making decisions at the beginning of the process because ultimately they'll get the chance to make their asylum claim. And then the in practice fact that this decision by Border Patrol at the beginning of the process ends up having massive implications for whether or not you're ultimately able to stay in the U.S. So, and at all to say anything of, like, the people getting sent to Guatemala who don't get to make claims at all.
Well, so, okay, here, I think we should draw some distinctions here and help people understand.
Sorry.
Right? So set Guatemala aside.
Yeah,
right?
Fair.
Okay, so you're going to make an asylum claim.
Yes.
And part of the Trump administration's concern about this whole thing is that people come with no regard for their prospects of prevailing at an asylum hearing, that what they really want is just to be released into the interior of the United States pending a hearing, because then they can work, do whatever, connect with extended family, blah, 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 blah. So remain in Mexico is supposed to allegedly solve that incentive mismatch, right?
Exactly.
That remaining in Mexico by design is, like, not that great. So you would only want to do it if you thought you would really prevail at your asylum hearing, because the goal is to get to the United States. And under remain in Mexico, the only way to get to the United States is to win at your asylum hearing, whereas under parole, you get some time in the U.S., you might just skip out.
Although, fun fact, the few people who have been given whose asylum claims have been approved by an immigration judge via the Remain in Mexico program, in at least some of those cases, they have been sent back to Mexico because the government has said, we're going to appeal this.
Right.
So, in theory,
sure,
that is the only way to get through them to the U.S. In practice, it is not a guarantee.
But then what you're saying is that your actual prospects of prevailing at the asylum hearing are themselves deeply impacted by whether you are able to push that case from inside the U.S. where we have American immigration lawyers, or if you're in Mexico where, by definition, if you're an American attorney, expert in dealing with the American immigration court process, like, you're not going to be in Mexico.
Right. And, you know, there always has been, and I think it's because immigration law is generally federal law, I think that this can be a little bit tricky for people to wrap their heads around, but there is already a certain amount of geographic variation in how likely you are to get your asylum claim approved. There's this weird system where jurisprudence is like simultaneously set by the immigration court system, which if you're a Weeds listener, you'll remember is under the Department of Justice. So it's not a fully independent court system, but also some jurisprudence is set through federal courts. And so in like the Ninth Circuit, the precedent says it's a little bit easier to make an asylum claim based on, say, being a member of a family that's being targeted than it is in the Fifth Circuit.
The Fifth Circuit is Texas.
Fifth Circuit does include Texas.
And the Ninth Circuit is California.
Yeah. You know, that kind of already did exist to a certain extent. Some judges were more lenient than others. Some cities have more pro bono immigration lawyers than others.
Can I ask very quickly, because that was something I actually wanted to talk about, is just the differing understandings of what you can receive asylum for.
Oh, gosh.
Something that you've talked about is how asylum seekers who are fleeing violence coming from their government are considered very differently from, say, LGBT people who are seeking, who may not be being persecuted by the government writ large, but everyone around them. Or in this particular story that you're talking about, you know, this is a couple who's being threatened by gang violence.
Right.
And, you know, David, one of the people you talked to, you know, he was shot twice.
Yep.
His uncle and his sister were murdered. And, you know, so he is experiencing violence coming from, like, a specific group of people.
Right.
But you've talked before about how the current administration has very differing views on whether or not that constitutes a true threat.
Right. I mean, it is a fundamental truth of asylum law that there are people who are absolutely convinced they will be killed in their home countries and might be right and do not nonetheless qualify for asylum. The question is, at what point does the danger that you are facing fall into the category of persecution? Remember that asylum law as we know it is really rooted in the response to the Holocaust. And so there's this idea that the most inescapable persecution is based on a group identity, probably an immutable group identity, and that it's coming from the government. And so the text of actual asylum law says that you can be persecuted based on one of five things: race, nationality, political opinion, religion, or membership in a particular social group. One of these things is not like the others. Obviously, particular social group doesn't have the same kind of like readily obvious meaning. And so a lot of this kind of weird jurisprudence that varies by jurisdiction to jurisdiction depends on how do you define a particular social group and what counts as being targeted based on that versus just like you come from a shitty place, your life kind of sucks, you're fleeing generalized violence or you're fleeing a personal vendetta. Like those two things definitely don't count as asylum or definitely don't count for asylum. Some kind of group-based targeting in the middle does. So this particular case, this family's case was really, it's a bubble case under current asylum law because they definitely are under threat and the entire family is definitely under threat, but they're not under threat from a government. The government, they tried to move to different places in Honduras and it didn't necessarily protect them. So there's an argument to be made that the government isn't sufficient to keep them from facing this. But like, at what point do you say that they're persecuted based on the family as a whole is being targeted? And, you know, one of the kind of twists and turns in this story is that there was a precedent issued by Attorney General Barr last summer that said you can't make asylum claims based on your family is being targeted unless, like, everybody in your society knows who your family is. So unless it's, like, Kardashian-level fame, essentially, you don't get to say my family is a particular social group. That decision came down after this family had entered the U.S. and been separated. And in theory, the mother of the family, who was at that point living in San Jose, could have put in an asylum application. The other, like, weird thing about this case is that they never bothered to file her paperwork with the court. So instead of having an appointed hearing with an immigration judge, she had to, like, apply proactively for asylum as if she'd, like, come in on a visa. But she could have filed that application before this decision came down, except that she had been separated from her husband or from her partner. And so in order to get him included on her asylum application, she had to wait until they could get married, which, given that they were in two different countries, was very difficult. So because of kind of that you know, cascading chain and chain of cause and effect. Ultimately, by the time she filed her application, this new precedent had come down. And so the law under which her claim is being adjudicated is actually less favorable to her than it would have been if they'd been kept together to begin with.
Okay, let's take a break, because then I want to talk about that sort of big picture policy context.
Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. Your body is your own. That's why Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Today, lawmakers who oppose abortion are challenging Planned Parenthood. Affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. Planned Parenthood believes that health care is a basic human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common-sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies. They also work tirelessly to oppose the onslaught of new policies aimed at interfering with personal decisions best left to patients and their doctors. They won't give up and they won't back down. You can join Planned Parenthood in the fight to help make sure that the next generation can decide their own futures. The organization needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
Support for The Weeds comes from Burrow. Okay, are you ready for the understatement of the century? Buying furniture can be frustrating. You end up visiting a bunch of stores searching aimlessly for the right pieces to match your home, then spend hours trying to get those pieces together, or together again if you got it wrong the first time. And that's even if you were able to get it through the door. Burrow is a furniture company that wants to make the whole thing easier. Burrow's new Dune line features a contemporary yet timeless look inspired by the craftsmanship of classic mid-century construction. If you're looking to bring a sense of luxury, comfort, and durability to your outdoor spaces, you might want to consider Burrow. Like all of Burrow's pieces, they offer easy assembly and disassembly so you can move or store them away as needed. Not only that, they ship straight to your door for free. Listeners of The Weeds can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/weeds. That's Burrow, BURROW.com/weeds for 15% off. Burrow.com/weeds.
I think this is very important because, I mean, different judges might rule differently, but I think it's pretty clear that the view of Bill Barr and the view of Chad Wolf and the view of their predecessors in those positions at Justice and Homeland Security is that it should not be the policy of the United States to accept Central Americans fleeing MS-13 and what's the other one?
Barrio 18. There are a few. Just the Maras generally,
sure.
We'll say.
But the general phenomenon in which this family's case fits, right, which is a person living in the Northern Triangle, their family comes to be targeted by the local hegemonic criminal organization, and so they flee for their lives to the United States, that, like, the powers that be don't think those people should be given asylum in the United States, right? Like, that's what's – everything else that is happening in administration – of asylum cases flows, I think, from that policy conclusion, right? That they think it would be bad if a – because they believe that if it was easy,
right,
to get asylum in the United States on the basis of I have a – even if the fear for your life is completely bona fide, right, that there is in fact so many people who have perfectly bona fide fears of gang violence in Central America that if it was easy to get asylum on that basis, a lot of people would come, they would get asylum, and that would be bad for the United States of America. Right.
So there's also kind of the idea that, like, because it's not baked into the definition, it's not baked into traditional understandings of asylum that you get to claim asylum because you live in a failed state. Like, the difference between I'm being targeted by gangs and my government can't protect me versus I just live under a government that's not capable of providing for my basic needs. Like, the latter of those is not considered generally to allow you free rein to migrate anywhere else.
Right. So it's like there's no dispute, legally speaking. There's this kind of, like, gang edge case, but, like, there's no dispute at all that, like, just because, like, you live in Chad and it's incredibly poor and there are no prospects for economic growth, like, that is not a valid basis for asylum, right? Even though, like, it's terrible. And so, you know, I mean, I do think that's important because, like, this is such a heartbreaking story. Like, I'm sobbing reading about this kid who, you know, feels that he's been abandoned by his mother when really, it's, you know, an arbitrary bureaucratic.
When he was saying that, like, you know, you left me, mama, I'm just like, it's, well, especially because I think the thing that gets me about this that makes me just sit by myself and stare at a wall for a while is that we won't know what the ramifications of all of this are for years.
Right.
And this is happening a lot. Like, this is not like, you were talking about how you were unsure whether or not to tell this story because it ends relatively positively. But, yeah. I mean, relatively.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm really stretching the definition of relative, but just the fact that, like, this is, for the horror of this story, this is a relatively optimistic outcome. And this is, you know, this is happening across the country, and it's happening to kids who have understandably no idea what's going on. And just the ramifications, the enormity of the ramifications is kind of overwhelming.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it can be this is like, to pull back the curtain a little bit again, like, it can be really hard to write that in explicitly because I'm talking about people who I don't want to, just for the sake of saying, well, bad things could happen, kind of overwrite, you know, what I saw, which was a very happy reunion. And in conversations since with the family, they definitely, like, have concerns about their ability to stay in the U.S. long term. But, you know, there isn't, if I'm not hearing from the subjects of my story a kind of, oh, yeah, you know, I still really kind of have this, these lasting issues, I don't want to write that in. At the same time, you can't know what an experience this traumatic is going to produce in terms of, like, the long-term consequences or the things that they're not willing to open up to somebody who they don't know that well about. And it, so it can just be, you know, I think that those of us who were following family separation when it was happening as a kind of universal policy choice at the border in spring 2018, there was a lot of good public education going on there about the long-term consequences of trauma. But it's something that I think about a lot in any of these stories is the extremity of circumstances that people are being put through is itself the kind of thing that in other circumstances you could imagine being used as the basis for an asylum claim.
Right.
But I think this story, it's emblematic of what conservatives fear about liberals, right? Which is that this is so sympathetic. It's so horrifying to read about this family and the situation they faced in Honduras and what they were put through by the American government. And, like, I can't help but sympathize with them and want them to have, like, a super happy ending,
right,
where they go live in San Jose and they take advantage of the booming labor market in the Bay Area and where the housing situation is, like, dismal by the standards Americans are accustomed to, but, like, actually, like, compared to Honduras, like, it's great. And it becomes this, like, great American success story, right? And, like, that's what I want. That's the outcome that I want for these people. But then, like, the conservative on my shoulder, the, like, the mini Trump or Border Patrol agent or, you know, Trump voting guy who I met a couple weeks ago and talked about this with, is that, like, look, there's literally billions of people on the planet with very sad lives whose circumstances could be greatly improved by moving to the United States. And, like, what are you going to do, right? Like, the reason they don't all come move to the United States is that they're not allowed to, that treatment of people who try to move here without a valid visa is, in fact, not that good. And so even if your life is pretty bad in Cambodia or wherever, it's like, it's not worth it, right? It's not worth it to try this. And if you try to generalize that, like, liberal sympathy that we feel for this family, you're going to end up with an unsustainable process that crushes the system. And you have all these immigration lawyers running around. And, like, they're lawyers, right? And what lawyers do is they represent clients in cases.
Yes.
And so it's like, it's not your job as an immigration lawyer to say, like, cosmically, what should our policy be to low-skill immigrants? And so,
right,
like, they're very tunnel vision on this.
Yes.
Like, it's not my job. It's not my job. But it's like, you don't see, like, Democratic Party members of Congress introducing bills that are like the Open Borders Act of 2020 because we think it's sad that people can't all move here to the United States, right? But it's like that I think that would be – I think that's a valid conservative point, though, that it's like we need a policy that has systematic choices and like a stable equilibrium rather than treating each individual person in the most generous possible way if we're not actually prepared to see through the consequences of what that would mean. That if there were 122 people living in Honduras being targeted by gang violence like this, it would be really easy to say, like, just fucking let them come, right? But it's so many more people than that.
So I think that there are a couple – I mean, the thing about this is it's not like the U.S. doesn't have a way of resolving this conflict. It mm-hmm. does. That's what the asylum process is for, mm-hmm. right? It's for determining who are the people who fit within this category of things that we have, through our legislative process, determined we want to protect people from. Now, that system is, you know, you can argue that it's overloaded and inefficient because overloaded. You can argue that it is vulnerable to kind of the like catch and release concern of people absconding. You can make arguments like that. Instead of, well, the Trump administration has made some attempts to change the system so that they can just kind of hold people in custody for longer, which itself has access to counsel concerns. But like, it is an attempt to use the legislative process to fix this problem. But in addition to that, the administration's current strategy is just, we are going to use executive branch powers to root as many people out of that process as possible. And so, you know, one of the kind of twists and turns of border policy over the last year was that if this family had come like a couple of months later, they wouldn't have even been allowed to make asylum claims at all, because in July, the Trump administration said, you aren't eligible for asylum if you aren't from Mexico and came through Mexico to cross into the U.S. So, like, there's that, you know, there's all of these dispersal programs. None of this is happening from the basis of there are legitimate claims and illegitimate claims, and we want to sort out, you know, which ones fall into the people, the kind of people who we've already agreed to protect. It's, well, we might as well throw up our hands and see, you know, and just try to prevent as many, try to make it as difficult as possible for people to kind of gain the legal right to stay in the U.S. based on having been in the U.S. It's not only a series of kludges, it is exactly the same kind of choices being made based on individual circumstances, except instead of being the individual sympathetic circumstances right. of like, oh, your story makes me feel bad, there are the individual circumstances of, well, you happened to come to a station that has already promised to send 20 people to Guatemala today, or that has promised yeah. to like send people to Mexico, or, well, we sent the women and children on the first bus and we have to make our Mexico numbers with the second bus. This is not to say that I know exactly that that's what happened, but it is to say that there is no actual triage process that's happening. And so this isn't, what we have isn't exactly this system that conservatives want. It's a system that conservatives can tolerate if it gets them to, or that conservatives appear to be willing to tolerate because it gets them to a broader, you know, because they are more interested in people not being able to take advantage of the asylum system than they are in the kind of like negative error of worthy cases being turned away.
Right.
I think a lot of this really is, are you more tolerant of positive or negative error? And, you know, liberals tend to be okay with some people who might not ultimately deserve asylum getting to stay in the United States if it means that no one is getting sent back who might be killed. The thing is, the U.S. law is actually pretty clear about this. You're supposed to be very intolerant of negative error on this. That's why the initial asylum screening is so generous. And so, yes, it's true that that's to a certain extent a policy choice, but it's a policy choice that's kind of baked into the law, that you're really, really, really supposed to bend over backwards to ensure that no one is sent back to a country where they're going to be persecuted.
All right. With that, let's take a break and talk about getting sick in Taiwan.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise might just be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, sending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account could work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com, Wise.com.
Last week, Kanye West accused one of the biggest Twitch streamers of being an industry plant. It's an idea that comes up so often on platforms like TikTok and elsewhere.
You see people who have blown up seemingly overnight, and the question is, who's behind them, right? That's what everyone wants to know. Tipping the scales and pulling the lever to make them seemingly the next it thing on the internet.
This week on Power User, is it even possible to create an industry plant on the internet? And if so, how?
There's nothing I love better than a good empirical study that probably doesn't generalize, that we can just make wild assertions about.
Oh, gosh. And there's nothing I like better than using the methodology section to cast aspersions on conclusions like Matt's.
It's great. So the title is Do Elections Make You Sick? It is by Hung Hao Chang and Chad Meyerhofer. And it says that, yes, elections do make you sick in Taiwan. And they look at healthcare.
Yes, elections make Taiwanese people sick in Taiwan, at least.
They look at healthcare use in Taiwan. Taiwan, unlike the United States, is one of these countries that has like specified this is the election time series. And so you can look at that window and they show that healthcare use and expenses go up by 19% during that window. Those of us who listened to Sarah Cliff and Dylan Scott on the pod a few weeks ago know that Taiwan has a single payer type healthcare system with very, very low co-payments. So you can show up whenever you feel like it, and people feel like showing up a lot more during election campaigns. Also, Americans believe that this is happening to them, because the election is stressful and making them crazy. So based on this Taiwan data, it's totally true. It's not all in your head. Or if it is in your head, your psychological state is causing real physical health impacts.
Right. Like, this is the wild thing about this
study. Take it to the bank.
Is they acknowledge that they're not looking at, like, purely psychological care. But based on the medical data that they have, they find suggestive evidence that it's not increasing mental health usage. It's only increasing usage of the healthcare system for like physical ailments, which like, yes,
there have
some
been
of the
way
things
more
they,
people getting the flu since.
Or like gastrointestinal, right. In this paper, they're talking about like gastrointestinal complaints, like the kind of things that you could imagine being psychosomatic. Yeah. But in order to grant the premise of this paper, you have to like thread the needle of, okay, this election-related stress is causing the kind of physical ailments that I would associate with mental distress.
Right.
But it's not causing mental health ailments.
Which seems, I mean, that's a tough—
But Jay, talk about what's been happening in our office.
We have been victims. I have been a victim of the—I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor of the murder flu.
So many other people.
And it genuinely, if you are sick, please stay wherever you are. Keep listening to this podcast and other podcasts on the Vox Media Podcast Network. Do not leave your home because it is, and because you won't want to, because you'll be lying in bed, unable to physically watch television, just having the television on.
Which is why you should be listening to The Weeds.
Exactly. It actually was a really good time for podcasts. If I had had any of the mental acuity to listen to anything, I did not at the time. But anyway, yeah, everyone's getting sick, and I think that, is it psychosomatic? I don't know. Did it make me feel like a human garbage can? Yes, it did.
The other thing about this kind of compressed election schedule in Taiwan, and when we're talking about compressed, like, this study looks at presidential elections, which have a 4-week campaign period, and mayoral elections, which have a 1-week campaign period, which is crazy, go nuts.
Wouldn't that be great?
I almost worry that 1 week is probably too short for local elections in the U.S. because you know, it's people have enough trouble figuring out who's running in local elections anyway.
You would read maybe one article.
Right, right. We could only tape one podcast for all of Taiwanese mayoral races. It would be so terrible. Anyway, because of that, there's this idea that that events during those campaigns are more intense, that like mass rallies in particular, like they flag injuries as something that could be caused by these kind of like very intense mass rally.
Right. Bernie
politics.
Did this rally with the Strokes.
That's
yesterday.
Not causing any right. injuries. No one. It's not 2003.
Just a lot of like moody.
So
it's not 2003. We've moved
the
on.
The implication there is that even though we think of this U.S. campaign as being so stressful, and I think we really are in the throes of, if you're particularly invested in Democratic Party politics, this is probably the part of the cycle that is going to be the worst for you because things are happening all the time and emotions are very heightened and the stakes are very heightened. But if it's a slog, it might actually be less acute in terms of the mental inflections. That's kind of the theory, you know, of like, oh, this 4-week campaign is going to cause a lot of things right. that are then kind of resolved after the campaign. The other thing that, you know, that's interesting about this is the American studies that they're comparing it to aren't actually studies. There are some during the campaign studies, but there's also a lot of existing literature about how Americans responded to, in particular, the 2016 presidential election, showing a lot of like reports of higher stress, increased cortisol levels, that kind of thing. And it does strike me as interesting that if you're hypothesizing a higher degree of stress causing, you know, physical ailments during the campaign, that like that's not going to persist after the election. Like, presumably some people, especially if you're looking at younger voters, which they are, who tend to support the minority party in Taiwan,
right.
like presumably some of those people would also be distressed about the result of the election. And that's not something up that's turning up, something that's turning up in the data. And it's curious.
It is.
Indeed. Yeah. I don't know. I still buy it. Elections make you sick. It could be even worse, though, if people went to rally. Basically, don't participate in politics. Just stay home behind your desk, listening to podcasts, maybe tweeting
yep.
occasionally about your favorite candidates.
Kind of performative politics.
Yeah,
that,
exactly.
That seems healthier.
Tweeting and just expressing yourself is the really effective way to engage in politics. Don't come to meetings. Don't engage face-to-face.
I was going to use a Marilyn Manson quote here, but you actually, like, out-darked even that.
Yeah, this
wow,
is...
That's,
it's no, I don't agree with any of that. Get out, do things.
Or, right, you know,
just
or
wash
do things.
Your hands, for the love of God.
Phone
just
bank,
wash your
text
hands.
People, do things from the comfort of your home
that's
aren't
a good
going
point.
To get you injured.
Or the murder flu.
I want to do a pod soon about phone banking and texting and the evidence on whether that does any good.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's increasingly looks bleak.
Well, I guess we should probably wait for the New Hampshire results. And
it's
see.
True.
We'll see what happens.
Maybe by the next podcast, we'll actually know who won the Iowa caucus.
No, we'll never know. I have written two different winners and losers from the Iowa caucuses article. Neither of them have run because we don't know what's happening. And it is making me physically ill. They're going to need to do a special instrumentation of that. But like the phone banking, right? Like imagine like you are sitting at home relaxing, listening to The Weeds, your other favorite Vox Media Podcast Network shows, you know, a little pivot. Whatever. And then somebody just like phones you up and they're like, hey, I'm a total stranger. I'd like to hassle you on behalf of a political candidate. Nobody wants that.
All right. This is a separate episode for a separate time with some actual poli-sci reading between
okay,
now and then.
Okay. We're going to wrap it up. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much. Everybody should, you know, read the actual article. It's really, it's a great reporting also. It's heartbreaking, but you know, in a good way. It'll make you feel like you've done something useful. Thanks to Malachi Brodus, our engineer, Jackson Bierfeld, our editor. Jeff Geld is back as producer of the show. Hooray! And we're really excited. And The Weeds will be back on Friday.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.